meaning of nine letters spaced between, or a parsha psukha where the word ends, then there's a total space till the end of the line, and then the next line starts at the beginning of the line with a space in between. Those are parshios. A sedra is made up of many parshios. This sedra doesn't have any parshios. The whole episode of Bilam and Balak is one run-on. If you look in the Sefer Torah, there's no paragraphs. Very hard to find your place in this place. Okay. Usually an aliyah ends at the end of a parsha. You know, it's easy. For Bal Koreh, this sedra is very difficult. Why? So the Chafetz Chaim says an interesting idea. The Gemara says, what is the purpose of those parshios? Right? Torah has to be written like that. If you write a Sefer Torah and you don't put in the right paragraphs, it's not kosher. So it's part of how the Torah was given. It's not just, you know, something nice that somebody decided to do for the sake of the artwork of the Torah. When the Torah was given, the letters were dictated and the paragraphs. So the Gemara says that the paragraphs represent when God told Moshe Rabbeinu to write the Torah, he dictated it to him, and he basically taught it to him. And each parsha was a shiur to itself. So every time there's a parsha, it means that God stopped there and told Moshe Rabbeinu, consider what I told you, think about it, review it, and then we'll go on. So the parsha signifies where Moshe Rabbeinu was told to think, contemplate, ponder, review. Says the Chafetz Chaim, that is why Bilam remained Bilam and Moshe Rabbeinu was Moshe Rabbeinu. They both basically have the same potential. Bilam was given the same potential for prophecy that Moshe was given. And yet Bilam became a Rasha and Moshe Rabbeinu was Moshe Rabbeinu. What was the difference between them? When Moshe Rabbeinu received the prophecy, he reviewed it, he thought about it, made an impression on him. And when Bilam received a prophecy or whatever, some kind of inspiration, he just went on. He never bothered to think. He never bothered to review it. And if you don't think, then the greatest things can make no impression on you. Therefore, according to the Chafetz Chaim, the main fault of Bilam, why he didn't develop his potential, is because he never bothered to think, contemplate. He just kept going on and on without taking things into consideration. I have a proof to this Chafetz Chaim. Not that Chafetz Chaim needs my proofs, but I found a medrash that says exactly what the Chafetz Chaim relates. A medrash is way back in Shmos, in Parshas Vaera, by the plague of Barad, hail. Moshe Rabbeinu tells Paro, the next plague is hail. Anybody who believes me that there's going to be hail tomorrow should bring his cattle into the house and it won't be affected. Anybody who leaves his cattle out in the field, it's going to be killed. His cattle, his slaves, they're going to be killed by the hail. So the Torah says like this, Hayorei es devar Hashem. The Egyptians who feared God's word brought their cattle in from the field and it was saved. Va'asher lo tzadah, but va'asher lo sam libo, and someone who didn't pay attention, who didn't put his heart to it, left his cattle in the field and it was killed. The Medrash comments on this sentence because it sounds like it's not just whoever feared God and whoever didn't pay attention, but it sounds like it's referring to somebody special. Hayorei es devar Hashem. The person who was God-fearing brought his cattle in. And the one who didn't pay attention left his cattle outside. Says the Medrash, Hayorei es devar Hashem refers to Yisro. Yisro was one of the advisors of Paro. He was a God-fearing person. When Moshe said, if you leave your cattle outside, it's going to get killed by the hail, he brought his cattle inside. Vasher lo sam libo ze Bilam. Bilam was also an advisor to Paro. The one who didn't pay attention, that was Bilam. Now, if you notice, it doesn't say the one who feared God brought his cattle in. And the one who didn't fear God didn't. It doesn't say that. Bilam also feared God. Vasher lo sam libo. He didn't take it to heart. Meaning he heard, he never thought about it. If you don't think about something, even the most simple, obvious things pass you by. And that was Bilam's problem. A proof to that, another proof, is what it says in this Sedra. Any of you have pets, dogs, cats? Yeah, goldfish, something? Okay. You're walking your dog, okay? And the dog turns around and says, could you slow the pace a little bit? It's a little fast for me. What do you think you do?
Slow the pace.
What? Faint, scream, call the newspaper, something, right? Right. Bilam, the first and last time in history that a donkey spoke was by Bilam. It wasn't something that ever happened before. Bilam hits his donkey three times, and the donkey turns around and starts to argue with Bilam. Why are you hitting me for? Do I deserve this? What does Bilam do? Talks to it like it's his friend. Like this is something usual. Happened yesterday, day before, right? What else do you do when a donkey talks? Answer it. It's absurd. Bilam should have fainted. He should have started screaming something. Don't answer the donkey. Tells Rosh Hashiva says, if you don't think and you're not prepared for something, then the most miraculous things just pass you by and you deal with them as if they're a natural occurrence. That's what happens when you don't think. And the Navi says that. We're now getting ready almost to usher in the 3 weeks. Mashiach hopefully will come before Shavuos or Thomas. We're at the fast. It'll be a Yontif. But the 3 weeks is going to come one way or the other. It'll be a Yontif or it's going to be another time of mourning. And the Navi Yeshayahu says, why are we in Golus? What is the root, the foundation? We did a lot of sins, and it says what kind of sin, but what brought us to those sins? So the Navi says, Yoda Shor Kolnehu, an ox knows its master, V'chamor Evus Ba'olav, and a donkey knows, doesn't know who his master is, but he knows who feeds it. It knows where the feed bag of its master is. It knows where it gets its meal from. And it has a certain amount of gratitude. Yisrael lo yada. The Jewish people didn't know who their master is and who feeds them. Why? Because ami lo hisbonan. Because they didn't think. Meaning, animals were not blessed with intelligence. Therefore, they were given instincts. Instinctively, they know certain things which they have to know for their survival. But human beings were blessed with intelligence. And what is instinctive to an animal is not understood by a human being unless he thinks. And if he doesn't think, the most simple instinctive things to animals are not recognized by human beings. Because people don't think. And that is the difference between somebody who ends up a Moshe Rabbeinu with his potential and somebody who never develops his potential or develops it for the bad because he doesn't think, doesn't ponder. Therefore, this Sedra doesn't have parshios because it signifies the fact that Bilam never stopped to think. Now, there's another Sedra. There's really two more Sedras. Another Sedra just like this, Vayetze. Vayetze deals with Yaakov and his dealings with Lavan. Vayetze Yaakov mi Beersheva and all the dealings with Lavan. There's an interesting connection. Because the Zohar says, in Kabbalah, Lavan and Bilam were the same person. Not necessarily the same person, Mamish, because it was hundreds of years in between. But Bilam was a Gilgul of Lavan. And what that means does not necessarily mean he was a reincarnation. It means they shared a sister souls. Everybody, we mentioned this when we spoke about 600,000 letters in the Torah that corresponds to the 600,000 neshamos of the Jewish people. We said there's a lot more Jewish people than 600,000. Does that mean some of us don't have souls? No. What it means is, and besides that, the 600,000 was the men between 20 and 60. Didn't include the women, didn't include the children, old people. The answer is that there are clusters of souls. every root soul of those 600,000 is really a cluster of souls. It includes many souls. Every cluster has an orange. There are slices, whatever, right?
Sections
of an orange. So each section is a thing to itself, but it's also part of that entire cluster, a cluster of grapes. And each neshama is a separate neshama, and it comes in this world at a certain time in history. But it has a connection, a very close connection, to all the other neshamas of that cluster. And therefore they're very similar, and they sometimes share memories. That's why they have these people who regress people hypnotically, and they remember things from past lives. It doesn't necessarily mean that they lived before, though, that they were those people. What it means is all these neshamas are one cluster. One came around in the year 1000, one in the year 1200, 1500, or whatever, in different periods of history, and they share a common memory soul-wise because they're all part of one cluster, but each one's a different person. So part of my sister neshama may be somebody who was here 1,000 years ago, and I have a connection to the memory of that neshama. It wasn't me. But it was a part of the clusters of neshamas that I'm connected to. So, therefore, Lavan and Bilam were part of that same cluster. That means that they had a connection to each other. If that's the case, it makes a lot of sense why the Parsha Vayetze would be another Parsha without Parshios. Because if the weakness of Bilam, who was also Lavan, is that he didn't bother to think, then the same message is given in Parshas Vayetze about Lavan as in Parshas... there's only one problem. There's another Parshas like that, Miketz. Miketz doesn't speak about Lavan or Bilam, but I have another reason why Miketz is like that, and it could apply to Vayetze also, and even to Balak for a different reason the Chafetz Chaim says. But for the time being, those are the three Seders that I know of that don't have any Parshas. Okay. Next. Any questions on that? If not, we'll go on to something else. Yes? Okay. Yes and no. Yes and no. There is such a thing that there is, every neshama has a male and female aspect, and sometimes, but not necessarily, a person gets the other side of his neshama as his bashert. It's not necessarily that way. Those neshamas will eventually mesh, but not necessarily in this world. Sometimes yes, sometimes not. And it also answers, even if you have a bashert, what about a second marriage? People are sometimes married three times. But if you have this idea of clusters, then there's more than one neshama that you have a connection to, so it's very possible that you meet up with another part of that cluster in this world too. But it's not necessarily the case, because the ultimate connection between the male and female part of every neshama is not necessarily in this world. Okay. Bilam says that we are an Am Levadad Yishkon. We're a nation that dwells apart. What does that mean? A nation that dwells apart. That means we're supposed to be separate from the nations of the world. We're supposed to be isolated from them. We lock ourselves up in Eretz Yisrael, isolate ourselves, and that's how we're supposed to be. No. The word Levadad does not mean isolated. In my estimation, it means insulated. Bidud is insulation. Levadad means we are supposed to be an insulated nation, which means the following. We have a mission in this world that is different than the mission of the nations of the world. We don't believe that only Jews get Olam Haba. Okay? We believe that God created non-Jews, and they also have a purpose in this world. And a non-Jew who keeps his seven mitzvahs and does it properly with the right intention can get a share in the world to come. So what's the difference between Jews and non-Jews? We have 613 mitzvahs, they only have 7 mitzvahs. The difference is that we have a different mission in this world. They are supposed to be moral. And if they keep their 7 mitzvahs, 7 is the number of nature. If they maintain themselves within nature and don't abuse nature, they're moral, they'll get a share in the world to come. They're supposed to develop this physical world properly and not corrupt it and not pollute it spiritually or physically and live a moral life. That's a non-Jew. A Jew is supposed to be Mamleches Kohanim V'Goy Kadosh. We are supposed to be a nation of Kohanim, a holy nation. What does that mean? A Kohen is God's representative to the world. To God's representative to the Jewish people. We are the Kohanim of the world. We represent God to the world. We don't do that by handing out his calling card. I represent God. You need him? Give me a call. We do it by fulfilling the second part of the phrase, Goy Kadosh, by being a holy nation. A holy nation does not mean one who sits in the corner and says Tehillim all day. That's not necessarily, that's very nice, but that's not necessarily what holiness is. Holiness is every aspect of your life. You live in a way that bespeaks godliness. That when someone sees how you live, whether it's your economic life, your social life, your married life, your political life, you do it in a way that's godly. I always like to explain the following pasuk. It says, "V'avdil eschem min ha'amim lios li." I separated you from the nations of the world to be mine. On that, Rashi brings a chazal. Im atem muvdali matem shali. If you separate yourself from the nations of the world, you're mine. And if not, you belong to Nebuchadnezzar and his friends. The obvious question is, it seemingly says, if you separate yourself from the Goyim, and you don't do all the abominable things they do, then I'll protect you, you're mine. If not, I'll give you into the hands of your enemies if you do all these terrible things. But it doesn't say that. It doesn't say, I'll protect you or I'll give you into the hands of your enemies. It says you belong to Nebuchadnezzar. Hare atem shel Nebuchadnezzar. And why mention Nebuchadnezzar? We had so many other enemies before him, after him. Why mention him? So I like to explain it in the following way, and it goes along with a story. I don't know if I told the story here before. Some of you have been at other shiurim. I'm sure you've heard the story from me. But don't worry about it, because I heard it more times from me than you could possibly have heard it from. So it's a true story, and it brings out the point I want to mention. A non-Jew has to keep 7 mitzvahs, like we said, remain in harmony with nature, not destroy, corrupt, pollute the world physically or spiritually, and he'll get a share in the world to come, because his job is to be moral and to create the infrastructure for holiness to descend into this world through the Jewish people. But our job is a different job. I always like to illustrate, not to imply that this is the life that non-Jews live, but to say that even if a non-Jew lived a life like this, they'll still get a share in the world to come. I was once on a plane traveling between New York and Cleveland. It was in New York going back to Cleveland. And the plane taxied onto the runway, and instead of taking off, pulled off to the side of the runway and just sat there. Obviously, there was something wrong with the plane. I never found out what it was. And we sat there. It was already 45 minutes. The plane wasn't taking off. Everybody was getting nervous. What's wrong? Why are we sitting on the side of the runway? And they didn't want to tell us, obviously. So they saw people really getting nervous. So they started to serve free drinks. And I don't mean Coca-Cola. Okay, free alcoholic drinks. The Irishman behind me, who was in his mid-50s, had a few too many of these free drinks. And he got real happy. So he gets himself up and he starts walking around the plane looking for friends of Clevelanders who are going back from New York to Cleveland And he tells him, I want you to come around my seat. I want to tell you a story. So I have about 6-7 people standing. I'm sitting right in front of him. So around my seat and his seat are 6 or 7 people waiting with bated breath to hear his story. Now, he was talking so loud, because he was a little bit drunk, that if I was in another plane, I could have heard him. Earplugs would not have helped. So I said, look, I'm stuck here. There's no way that I can't listen to the story. I hope it's something I'm allowed to hear. And I assume God wants me to hear it, so I'm going to pay attention, because I can't escape it. This was the story, almost word for word. He tells his friends, he says, you know, my wife died about 6 months ago, and I was in a terrible depression. And my son is a wealthy physician in New York, and he called me a few weeks ago, and he said, Dad, you're in a terrible depression. We got to get you out of it. I want you to come to New York on my expense. I'll put you up in a 5-star hotel, and I will take you every day to see the sights of New York. And maybe it'll get your mind off our mother, and you'll be able to get out of your depression. So I took him up on it, put me up in this beautiful hotel, and he, what's it called, showed me all the sights, took me to the Empire State Building, and all the different sights of the Statue of Liberty or whatever. All the sights, right, Twin Towers, all the sights of New York. He said, but last night was the zenith of my trip. Last night, my son took me to one of the 10 most luxurious restaurants in the world that is in New York. He mentioned the name of the restaurant. I'm sure the kashrus is not up to my standards. It didn't make that much of a difference. He said, you have no idea. I never saw a restaurant like this in my life. They sat us down by a table that was fit for King Arthur. Everybody had their own little throne. We sat down. They gave us the menu. Said, the menu, half of it I couldn't read. It wasn't in English. He said, the part I could read, I saw that the most expensive item on the menu, which was very expensive, was a 7-course dinner where the main course was a 3-pound steak. Now, you have to understand what that means, 3-pound steak. In the fast food places, a hamburger is a 1/4 pound of beef. That means 12 of them is 3 pounds of steak. It was a little cow that they sold, that they served you, with 7 courses surrounding it and side dishes. So I said to myself, the man tells his friends, I don't know if I'll ever be in a restaurant like this again in my life. My son can afford it. I'm going for the top of the menu. And I ordered the 7-course, 3-pound steak meal. And they served it from soup to nuts, and I finished it completely. When I finished it, I see 2 distinguished gentlemen in tuxedos standing at my table, and one of them's holding a scroll. The one with the scroll introduces himself, and he says, I'm the maitre d' of this restaurant. And the gentleman next to me is the owner of the restaurant. And we want you to know that you are the 7th person in history, the history of this restaurant, that ordered the 7-course, 3-pound steak meal and finished it. And didn't ask for a doggy bag to take the leftovers home. And we have prepared a scroll for an occasion like this. It has blanks for your name and the date. We want you to take this home as a souvenir, as a testimony that you did this great feat in our restaurant of finishing the 3-pound steak meal. So they filled in my name in calligraphy. They filled in the date. They signed it. And they handed me the scroll. The man now has tears welled up in his eyes. He says, you have no idea how I felt. He said, but that was nothing. He said, after they gave me the scroll, they said, look opposite your table at the wall opposite your table. You will see 6 bronze plaques with names and dates on them. Those are the names of the people who finished the 3-pound steak meal before you and the dates that they did it. Tomorrow we're going out and buying a 7th bronze plaque with your name and tonight's date, and your name will be on the wall of this restaurant for posterity. Everybody who comes here will know that you finished a 3-pound steak, right, on this night. Now, at that point, I wanted to turn around and ask if those little bronze plaques had little bulbs on them, because that would have... Right, that would not have been a great... great sign of what happened to the people who finished the 3 pounds of steak before him. But I kept my mouth shut, and I listened. The man now was crying, mamish crying like a baby. He said, "You have no idea how I felt." He said, "You know, I feel fulfilled. I don't know if I have any more purpose to live." That's what he said. At that point, I started to daven very strongly that before this plane takes off, somebody stand up who heard this story, and everybody on the plane heard the story, and tells this man that he knows of a restaurant somewhere in the world that serves a 4-pound steak meal. What difference did it make to me? I was afraid in the heavenly court they heard what he said, and they said, "You know, he's right. He has no more purpose to live." So when the plane takes off, they're taking him down, and I'm sitting right in front of him. I don't know if I can, you know, survive this. So I'm hoping he has a purpose to live before we take off. Another pound of steak. A non-Jew could live a life where his entire focus in life is to eat 3 pounds of steak in a fancy restaurant, as long as he didn't steal the meat. He didn't curse God because it was too tough. He didn't serve idolatry. He wasn't immoral. He didn't kill anybody over the steak, right? And what did I miss? What? Right, he didn't take it from a living animal. He'll get Olam Haba for it. If a Jew lives a life like that, he won't get the world to come, because we have a greater mission. We can't just be moral. We have to be holy. And holiness means in every aspect of life. Every aspect of life. I'll give you an example of holiness. I think we may have mentioned this at some point before. There's a man, Aaron Feuerstein, who lived on the outskirts of Boston. I think he recently was nifter. He owned a textile mill and employed hundreds of employees. His textile mill burnt to the ground. And he could have morally told his workers, "I'm sorry, I don't have a business. So you don't have a job. You can all get jobs somewhere. If you're available when I rebuild my business, I'd be happy to hire you back. But, you know, no guarantees. I don't have a business." He didn't do that. He kept them all on the payroll, not to pay them the wages. For the entire, it took, I don't know how many months or years it took to rebuild the business. He kept them all on the payroll. They shouldn't lose their pensions, their medical benefits. And he told them, "Look, you can get other jobs, but if you want, when I rebuild my business, you all have your jobs. You're all on the payroll." And it was picked up by the media all over the world. He's a religious man, a Jewish religious man. And they said, "This is something special." Because morally, no one would have had any bone of contention with him if he told them all they have no job. But this is something beyond moral. This is holy. That's how a Jew has to be. That even in his economic life has to deal in a way that's a notch above morality. That's called holiness in every area. Every area. And in order to be able to maintain that lifestyle, we have to remain not isolated from the world, because we're supposed to influence the world, but insulated from the world. We have to create a society that's insular. And that's what Eretz Yisrael is all about. The purpose of Eretz Yisrael is to create a holy society where every aspect of life, our physical, economic, political, social, married, every aspect of life is a notch above what everybody else is expected to do. Not moral, but moral plus, holy. Here in Eretz Yisrael these days, we are accomplishing that at least in one sphere, a political sphere. Because when the nations of the world hear about Israeli politics, what do they say? "Oh my God." So we are influencing the world with godliness, with our politics. But it's not exactly supposed to be like that. They're supposed to be... And we don't really have a choice. God didn't give us a choice. Whether we want this, he gave us the position, right? We are capable of doing it because we inherited this potential from our avos and imahos, from Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah, and we don't have a choice. We have to be a mamleches kohanim v'goy kadosh, whether we like it or not. And in order to do that, we have to live as an am levadad yishkon. We have to live insulated from the rest of the world, because if we're not, and we live mixed in with the rest of the world, we're going to be influenced by their moral lifestyle, not the bad ones, the good ones. That's what it means. I separated you from the nations of the world to be mine. If you separate yourself and you live a different kind of existence, you live an existence that represents holiness, then you're mine. You're my representatives. But if you don't, and you live the same moral existence as the best of the non-Jews, but not holiness, then you belong to Nebuchadnezzar. What does that mean? What did Nebuchadnezzar do? He destroyed the temple. We are the temple. We're the place where God's presence devolves in this world. Everybody is supposed to build their own personal temple in themselves. And in fact, it says, "V'yosuli mikdash v'shachanti b'socham." God doesn't dwell in the mikdash; He dwells in us. The mikdash is only a means to get God's presence amongst the Jewish people. We are God's temple. So a person who lives a life of morality but not holiness is basically destroying his own temple. So he belongs to the group of Nebuchadnezzar. You belong to the group of temple destroyers. Nebuchadnezzar destroyed a temple of wood and stone, and you're destroying the temple of your heart. In fact, the Chiddush Arim says in the Shulchan Aruch, it's proper, Roy lechol yirei shamayim lios mis'abel mis'onein tadir al beis mikdashenu. It's proper for every God-fearing person to mourn constantly the destruction of the temple. So Chiddush Arim asks, why does it use that preface? It's fitting that every Yirei Shamayim should mourn the temple. Everybody should mourn the temple. If you're not a Yirei Shamayim, you may not do it. But it's incumbent on everybody. It's not only incumbent on Yirei Shamayim. It doesn't say in the beginning of Hilchos Shabbos, everybody who's a Yirei Shamayim should keep Shabbos. No, everybody has to keep Shabbos. If you're not a Yirei Shamayim, you may not do it. But it's incumbent on everybody. Why mention it that a Yirei Shamayim should do this? Says the Chiddush Arim, because a person who's not a Yirei Shamayim first should mourn his own Churban before he worries about the Churban of the temple. Right? If you're a Yirei Shamayim, then you can worry about the Churban of a building. But if you're not a Yirei Shamayim, worry about your Churban first. So that's what we're supposed to be. We're an Am Levodad Yishkon. We dwell not isolated, but insulated. And that's what the purpose of Eretz Yisrael is. It's a holy land, has a direct connection with God. We're a holy people. We have a direct connection with God. We're supposed to create a society here that is not moral only, but holy also. And in that respect, that is what it means. And we really, like I said, don't have a choice. Because we are compared to oil, and the nations of the world are compared to water. Oil, by its nature, rises to the surface and is separate from the water. You can't mix oil with water. And if you try, eventually the oil rises to the surface. And that's what the Medrash says. The Medrash says we are always going to be badad, insulated, separated from the world. We can do it in a positive way, do it willingly. Then we read a pasuk on Simchas Torah, in Vezos HaBracha, Vayishkon Yisrael Betach Badad. The Jewish people dwell in security, insulated, separate from the world. Or we can choose not to do it willingly. And in the end, it's going to happen whether we like it or not. And then we read another pasuk, Eicha Yashva Vadad, except that we read on Tisha B'Av sitting on the floor. Badad remains the same. Question is, are you doing it willingly in a happy way, or are you doing it unwillingly and have to sit on the floor? Reb Chaim Volozhiner says it much more poignantly. He says the Jew has two choices. Either we make Kiddush, or the Goy will make Havdalah. Either we separate ourselves from the nations of the world by sanctifying ourselves, or if we choose not to do that, we choose to assimilate, eventually the Goy is going to make Havdalah. He's going to separate us. Because it's impossible for us to remain assimilated. It can't be. It eventually, the oil rises to the surface. And if you take that example, what makes the oil rise to the surface? The pressure of the water. The goy will push you out. He'll make sure that you're not assimilated. And throughout history, wherever we try to assimilate more into the cultures around us, Spain, Greece, Germany, Those are the places where the oil was pushed out more than anywhere else, because that is part of a safety valve that God has, that we will maintain our purpose in this world. And the more we try to assimilate the oil into the water, the more the pressure of the water pushes the oil out. A question? No? Okay. I don't think. Okay. So that's what it means, Am Levodod Yishkol. We're a nation that dwells insulated from the rest of the world. Okay? One last thing. We don't have time for the last thing I wanted to mention. We'll find some other excuse to speak about another parasha. But cute thing. It says that Bilam, how did he curse people? Well, let me tell you something else cute. I saw that, take 2 minutes, we have a little more than this. We have 4 minutes of two-minute things. One, the Sfarno, in the beginning of the Sedra. The Sfarno says, Balak says to Bilam, everybody knows whoever you bless is blessed, and whoever you curse is cursed, so I want to hire you to curse the Jewish people. Sfarno says, where do we find that Bilam had a power to bless people? He had a power to curse. How did he have a power to curse? He knew when God got angry, and he was able to channel that anger. If you take that 1 second, you can channel it, right? Destructive power. So that's what he knew. He knew when God would be angry, and he would channel the anger and destruction. That's how he knew how to curse people. So, but it doesn't say anywhere he knew how to bless people. So why did Balak say whoever, and not only that, if Balak really believed that Bilam could bless people, why did he hire him to curse the Jewish people? Hire him to bless you. Look, it's you or them. So bless me, forget about cursing them. Why curse them? Must be that Balak didn't believe that Bilam could bless people, he only believed he could curse people. So why did he say it? Says the Sfarno, because Balak knew that Bilam had no power to bless anybody. He only could curse. But he felt it was really an embarrassment, an insult to Bilam to say, you're a negative guy, you can curse people. So he added what he knew wasn't really true, but he didn't want to insult Bilam. He said, you're the only one who can bless people. Right? Means that even for a Bilam, it's an insult to say you're a negative person. Yet there are people who pride themselves of being like that, who all they can do is criticize and see bad in everything. It is obviously not a great praiseworthy thing to be a person like that. Because even Balak understood, I'd be insulting Bilam to say he's only a negative person. So I got to lie and say he also could do positive things. That's one lesson. If there's no great pride in being negative. The second thing is, okay, now that we gave the Hakdama, so what could Bilam do? He knew the second. It says that God is angry for a second every day. If you know how to harness that anger, you can direct it. It's like taking the sun's rays with a microscope, with a magnifying glass, concentrating it, you get a fire. So if you take that anger and you know how to direct it and channel it, you could cause terrible, terrible destruction. So Tosfos asks, what could he have said in a second? What could you say, a curse, in a second? So Tosfos says two answers. One is, if you start by that second, and everything that comes after is counted. Some bring a proof of that. If you start mincha at the last second that you can keep going. So once you started, right, everything else comes, is okay. Okay, but Tosfos says another answer. He says he could have said one word, kalein, destroy them. Chaf lamed mem, lechalos, to destroy. Kalein. So they say, that's what Tosfos says. They say if you think about it, the three blessings that Bilam gave, that which should have been curses, but they were changed into blessings, what do they start with? The first one was, Ki merosh tsuri merenu, I see him from the tops of the mountains, meaning from the ovos. The second one is, Lo hibit oven biyakov, God does not see iniquity amongst the Jewish people. And the third one was Matovu Alecha Yaakov. Those are the beginning sentences of the three blessings that really were curses that God changed into blessings. What are the first letters of those things? Ki Meirosh Surim is Chaf, Lo Hibit Oven is Lamed, and Matovu Alecha is Mem. That's Kalein. So he could have said Kalein, had in mind all that he was going to say, and curse them in 1 second. And that's not what's it called. Instead, the Rabbanu Shlom turned his curses into blessings, and we even have those blessings till today.